Welcome to Listeners' Voices, the Trains episode, if you didn't figure that out. Trains and other atypical types of transportation. This is Fran. I'm your host for this show and my co-host.
Francis.
Thank you for being here. So we've had good submissions for this show and quite almost a full show of recorded submissions, which is unusual, and long ones. But this really grabbed people, I guess, which is fun. So if you're new to the concept, we put out a prompt every couple weeks and people respond by either written or recorded responses. This week's are all recorded. And they send them usually or bring them in person. We have someone who brings us in person, but the email to contact us, ktwh.org. No, that's our website, ktwhwriters@gmail.com. And I do mention the website because that's where all our previous episodes so far have been archived. And that's ktwh.org under the programs dropdown. You'll find listeners' voices. So, Francis, tell us about the next episode coming up.
So, the next one will be on December 7th, and that episode will be on the topic of unexpected generosity, gifts of material or intangible generosity, whether your own story or another that moves you. So if that tickles your fancy, please send us something at ktwhwriters@gmail.com.
And we have a especially early deadline to this particular episode, right?
Yes, the weekend of December 7th and 8th is quite busy on many fronts, and I will not be available for Friday and Saturday, so we are hoping to record it on Thursday. So if you give us your responses by Wednesday, we should be able to fit it in.
Okay, great. Yeah, so I think that's all the usual routine we want to cover. I'm just going to tell a short little story of my very first encounters with trains, and then we've got people working on the railroad. We have a comparison of Amtrak to Canadian passenger travel and commuter travel and even by water travel form. I don't want to spoil the anticipation, but and then we even get into some hitchhiking stories. So I was in college at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and my roommate and I were out walking. We went walking in the countryside a lot, and we were along these tracks, and we came upon a freight train with some boxcars just stopped on the tracks. And we decided we were going to be really adventurous and get into the boxcars and see where it took us. And assuming it would either go back to Ann Arbor or to Ypsilanti, which is the next town over, as I recall, and then we would just get off there. So we were feeling really gutsy and got in and sat there and sat there and sat there. About a half hour later, I think we got off. Apparently, they were just stashed there for storage and weren't going to be going anyplace.
I think every kid who's ever heard about train travel, hobo train travel, has longed to do something like that.
Uh-huh. So these will be much more adventurous stories we're about to hear. And the first one from Tom Kohler doesn't identify himself, but this is our intrepid volunteer here at the radio station. Used to do readings of stories, which we probably will resurrect again sometime before too long in the early years. Some really fun stories, Mark Twain and things like that, some political humor. And but I knew he had a long time work experience with the DM&IR Railroad originally, now it is now Canadian National. So let's hear Tom. And then that'll be followed by Patrick Elver, also worked on the railroad at one time in his life, and we'll hear from him and a character he got to know while working for the railroad.
Railroading in Two Harbors half a century ago was a labor-intensive occupation, even though much of the work was mechanized. Still, in ordinary day-to-day track work in the Two Harbors section, a half a dozen or so men would be sent out with their hammers and shovels and picks to do the ordinary day-to-day work that was required in the Two Harbors yard to keep train traffic moving. There were mechanized gangs, of course. Then men would be formed up in a gang of maybe 50 to 70 men taking people from everywhere on the railroad and putting them to work on a mechanized gang to relay rail or replace ties. But in the ordinary daily work, it was shoveling snow in the wintertime to keep the track switches and road crossings clear of snow, and keeping the sidewalks clear to the yard office. My ordinary work as a section hand was rebuilding track, tearing up track, aligning track, leveling it. Much of this was done by hand, as you would see in old movies. The work was mechanized, but only if it was a high capital job. Otherwise, it was doing it the same way the Gandhi dancers did it 100 years ago. There's a certain grace and beauty in a skilled track worker swinging a 10-pound spike maul 5 times to drive a spike home in an oak tie. It was almost ballet-like in their grace. I, however, was clumsy as a warped board and generally relegated my labors to a number 2 or a number 8 shovel, depending upon whether it was track ballast or snow. Most of my work later on in my railroad career was as a track welder. We would fix flaws in the rail surface, or we would weld rails together using a thermite welding process that was developed by 1898. Since then, the process has changed only in the efficiency of the appliances that were used for controlling the thermite reaction and delivering the molten steel to the rail ends. Work was hard and brutal, and it went on whether the weather was nice or terrible. The worst days I had were in the wintertime. If it got down to 40 below, the propane would not come out of the tank, and so we couldn't do any preheating on a rail to weld it. So then we just had to stay in our truck and stay warm in the hopes that the temperature would miraculously rise above 40 below so that we could actually get some work done. In my case, that was not the case, and so we would just stay in the truck and stay warm. So there was some slack in railroading as well. You couldn't be on the tracks, obviously, when the trains were coming, so you had to be in contact with the dispatcher and the train crews and be aware of where the trains were. And if they were anywhere in the area, you did not go out on the main line because a train could be coming from any direction at any time. So we would hurry up and wait. If a track supervisor came along and we were in a truck sitting alongside the track, he didn't bother asking us why we were sitting there because he knew we were waiting on a train. I was doing some welding on a switch on the main line coming into the Two Harbors yard. A loaded ore train has to ride its brakes all the way down the hill from Waldo coming into the yard. And it was hard for them to keep the speed down because this was a very steep grade on a very heavy train. I had begun work on a switch that required either no traffic over it until I was done or at an extremely slow speed. I got a call from the dispatcher that a train was waiting in Waldo to come into the yard, and they were just about to run out of time. And so I told him, well, I says, I haven't got this thing welded yet. I can't let him go over it unless he can do it at 5 miles an hour or slower. The dispatcher told me, you know, that's a downhill grade and it's a hard thing to do. I said, I know that. And I was interrupted by the engineer on the inbound train. He says, you want 5 miles an hour, Tom? I'll give you 5 miles an hour. I says, okay, fine, come on in. And so that's the way of life for the track man. The trains always take priority. It doesn't matter what the weather is. And it just doesn't matter, whatever it takes to get the trains through. And so it was. After 32 years, I retired healthy from the track department, and this was my life in a 5-minute nutshell.
I saw a picture last week in a magazine of some railroad tracks in Chicago. The picture was familiar. I had been over those very tracks many times. I had even thrown the switches that were pictured because I spent about a year as a trainman working on the extra board for CNW. It was exciting to work for the railroad, not just because the wages were good, but because I felt a part of an old tradition, a job that was visibly a part of the American heritage. long trains moving through the countryside and the cities, delivering the products of our nation. The rise and fall of sound from the diesel engines and the wheels of steel rolling on rails, keeping rhythm like music. The sudden release of compressed air and the seemingly ancient sound of the horn fading away into some late night. They were all familiar to me since I was a child. The yard in which the trains were put together in Chicago were, and maybe still are, the largest in the country. The Proviso Yards, they are called, and they were really 9 different yards, each with its own yard master and different jobs to do. Being on the extra board meant that I got a phone call at any time of the day or night, and then I had 2 hours to get to work. The phone would ring, and a voice would say, "Job 9, yard 6, 10 o'clock. And then I'd be on my way. After a while, I got to know what job went with which number and what to expect at each different yard. And there were jobs that put you out in the middle of 80 tracks in the orange glow of a Chicago night, alone with a walkie-talkie to put together trains in the hump yard. After a while, if you had done a job often enough, you got a handle or a nickname that the engineers used to call you on the walkie-talkie. If I remember right, it was Job 9, Yard 6, that I first encountered Swamp Rat. He was a well-traveled loner, and as he said, he had been hiding out from the road for a while and working late nights in the railroad yards. This was in the early 70s, and Swamp Rat believed that he was a part of a disappearing culture, or counterculture, as he put it. He was not a prize-winning employee, prone at times to turning off his walkie-talkie just to finish telling some story he had started, or messing with a small FM radio, trying to keep it tuned to an underground station that graced the Chicago airwaves in those changing times. I remember him sitting on an old crate, rolling his cigarettes in the light of a lantern, telling fantastic stories about the mountains and the plains and the deserts from Alaska to Central America. Hitchhiking and hopping freights, he had been in every state west of the Mississippi and had seen endless night skies of stars and lonely sunrises over the Badlands. He had walked for days in remote places that saw a car only rarely and then hours apart. One of my favorite stories was the time that he and a traveling companion found a hot springs in Wyoming. They sat comfortably in the bubbling hot water, sipping on cold beer in the afternoon sun, and then watching it snow in the mountains beyond as elk grazed only 100 feet away. I still envy him and his life that songs were written about. Sometimes, though, Swamp Rat did not tell stories or even talk much for days at a time. The sadness would creep over him, and it seemed like a gray sky. And he spent his time, when not putting together trains, with a piece of yellow chalk writing Swamp Rat and then some strange symbol on the side of the railroad cars. They weren't really big, like he was bragging, but just big enough so that it could be read before time and weather would wash it away. There are not a lot of railroad crossings left anymore. Most of them are overpasses or on roads less traveled. There are times, though, that I find myself stooped behind the wheel and behind a blinking barrier, watching railroad cars slip by, straining my eyes to see if, after all these years, something is left of that yellow chalk scratched on some boxcar from some dark night, many years and lifetimes and miles in the past. Thanks for listening. This is Patrick Eller.
I've been working on the railroad all the livelong day. I've been working on the railroad just to pass the time away. Can't you hear the whistle blowing? Rise up so early in the morn. Can't you hear the captain shouting? Dinah, blow your horn. Oh, Dinah, won't you blow?
Thank you, both Tom and Patrick. And Tom's story, I'm going to briefly share something that his story reminded me of, thinking of that train coming down and needing to go really slowly, the grade going down into the Waldo being so steep. And actually, I just in the last week came upon this story from 1889. This was when the train still ran on the Drummond grade, which is much steeper. And as a train of 14 loaded cars with Superintendent Pope's private car attached was descending the heavy grade between Two Harbors and Gacadena, which is the Drummond grade, along the Drummond grade up by Stewart Lake, on the Duluth and Iron Range Railroad, the air brakes refused to work and the train gained frightful velocity. The brakeman managed to uncouple the private car, which was soon stopped by the handbrakes. The rest of the train plunged madly on, attaining a speed of 110 miles an hour. Finally, the train left the tracks, demolishing the engine and all the cars. Engineer Charles Coulter had both legs broken, and two other men were seriously injured. So that led to, within 10 years, they built an alternative route for that part of the
within 10 years.
You're right, yeah. Yep. And then they continued to use the Drummond grade for passenger traffic, but it was a much gentler grade. So just wanted to share that little tidbit. So now we have passenger travel on trains, and it was really fun to have that perspective of the people working on the trains. I hadn't even thought of that when we proposed this subject. So Katya is next, tells us about a trip with her family out east, which is interesting. I've been on the Amtrak several times going westward and back. They traveled out to D.C., I believe it was, and she pretty well covers what it's like to ride on the Amtrak as a passenger without your own private room.
Hello, this is Katya Gordon, and I am here to talk about trains. I have long hoped that trains will become the new means of travel around North America. And when my family started to talk about a trip to D.C. to talk to our legislators about carbon fee and dividend legislation, it seemed very fitting to not fly there and take a train as part of the experience. And our girls were teenagers. I think we did it twice. And basically, we drove down to Red Wing, Minnesota, and then picked up the train there. Unfortunately, there was nowhere to get it closer than St. Paul. And we took the train to Chicago, and then we would have a layover and have to get on another train. And we took this second train all the way to D.C. And there were parts of that journey that I absolutely loved. I loved being away from airports. I loved sort of the old-fashionedness of it. You just sit there and get on the train, and I think we had seats assigned, but there were cars, dining cars, lounge cars that were made of all windows. And it was made for extremely fascinating and relaxing travel, I found. Meaning you could read your book, but then you could get up and move around. We brought all our own food. And so every meal, we just went to one of the tables in the dining car and ate our meals. The girls did homework. We also found some very interesting discussions with going on, which we were able to listen to just by being around. It was very communal, meaning like there were many Amish people in the train. And they would speak in English, but it was so different of English. It was barely recognizable. And then what other groups did we listen to? There was, you know, a couple, some groups of young people that had some very X-rated discussions that we steered our teenagers' daughters away from. There were also hard parts about this. It does move very slowly. So when you're going through beautiful country and it's daylight, it's beautiful. Night was a challenge. Of course, you can get a bunk to sleep in, but that was very expensive. So we didn't. And the chairs would lie back somewhat. So we kind of spent the night trying to lie back in our chairs. I think we had blankets. You could also go to the lounge and try to lie on one of the sort of more couch-like things, but mostly those were taken up. And I am not one to be able to sleep away from home, so I pretty much accepted that I was going to not be getting sleep. I hadn't discovered earplugs yet. Good earplugs. But I do recall at least one night, like I recall one night where I decided to lie on the floor in the lounge because I could wouldn't have be facing a light and it was just seemed more stable and there was room and it's just so communal. There's just people lying around everywhere and you can do what you need to do. I loved that. Didn't get much sleep, but I did lie down on the floor for a while. I had some very deep conversations with some other Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers that we were traveling with, usually in the dead of night. And yeah, the other thing that I discovered is that it's slow, and we knew it would be slow, but we didn't really realize, like, when it that says the train will come in at 1 o'clock, it means the train will come in sometime between 1 and 4. It's really sort of like taking a step backwards in time, or at least it was. This was the Amtrak train. And I recall one night where I was lying there and we putted into Cincinnati, I think it was, and then stopped. And I think this was before smartphones, so I wasn't sure. I just remember not knowing where we were. Somehow I had learned that we were in Cincinnati, and then the train just stopped for about 45 minutes, and then it started to go backwards very slowly, and then eventually got moving again. But I just remember having a little bit of a struggle with that in my modern world where things are supposed to always run on time. So I will say we were exhausted when we got back. Mostly just from the length of it and the overnight part. But I still say as a means of travel, it was wonderful. And we planned to travel to the West Coast. We'd heard about the beautiful, beautiful trip you can do through the mountains to visit San Francisco. But the week before we were going to leave, the bridge, one of the bridges was flooded out in, out west. And the bridge was actually wiped all the way out. So that was the end of that train trip for at least a year. So trains, I believe, I still hope and believe are the wave of the future as far as their energy efficiency. And I just hope that trains with berths get cheaper so that regular people can have decent sleeps. I think that would have made a huge difference. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, that pretty well captures my experience traveling out west on Amtrak. I've been fortunate of my several trips, almost I would say 8 times out of 10, I had both seats to myself so I could kind of stretch out sideways.
That is lucky.
Yeah, and the seats do recline quite a bit. And there's a lot of room between you and the seat in front of you, on much better than on an airplane. So, but absolutely. She mentioned earplugs, and also I would suggest bringing blinders. They do turn lights pretty much out at after dark, but still it's helpful to be able to completely block out any light. Nonetheless, I never slept very well, but but you can take some steps to improve your chances. So this is interesting comparison. Becky and Judy made a trip up in Canada on the train, and they don't compare them directly themselves. I don't know if either of them has had much experience on Amtrak, but it's interesting hearing their experience too.
This is Becky in Two Harbors. The prompt this week is trains. I've had a few experiences with trains. A couple of things with my mother and brothers when I was little, and it was still a little more common to travel by train. And then once in the 70s, I took a train trip from Duluth to Madison when it was still possible to get on a passenger train in Duluth. And then the one I'm thinking about, the one I want to relate mostly, was an adventure with my friend Judy. I think it was in 2000 or 2001. It was in the middle of the summer. She invited me to go on a trip with her to visit her sister and brother-in-law at Quebec City. We went up into Canada and got on the train north of Thunder Bay. The train doesn't actually come down into Thunder Bay. It goes through Armstrong, which is a little community, oh, maybe an hour north of Thunder Bay. A friend of ours was living across the border and agreed to help us keeping my car while we went on this excursion. And so we got up there, and the train was going to arrive late at night. And so there's no passenger depot or anything. There's just this little loading platform. So here we are out there with our luggage late at night, and somebody came along and took pity on us and said, you know, it's going to be a while before the train actually comes. Why don't you come up and wait in the bunkhouse? Well, it turns out that Armstrong is where the East and West crews change off, that the transcontinental train, as it comes across Canada, one crew will come all the way from the West Coast to Armstrong, and then at that point, a different crew gets on, and the crew from the west waits for the train going the other direction and goes home, and vice versa. So that was interesting that was why there was a bunkhouse there. And we learned a little about the community of Armstrong, which is a teeny little place, comparable, I think, to about the size of Finland. And interesting in that the kids go through eighth grade there, and then they have to go down into Thunder Bay and board, or at least they did at that time. But we eventually got on the train and rode through the remainder of the night, and then a couple of my most memorable moments from that trip were in the early hours of the morning as we were going through quite wilderness area. One was going through a wetland and watching as a very large moose raised his head with his big rack of antlers to look up from his browsing of vegetation to watch this big train go by. That was quite spectacular. Another time the train stopped, and it was just out in the middle of nowhere. And I was looking out the window to try to see what was going on, and here was canoes being poked out of the baggage car. So somebody was starting one of those long canoe adventures by getting dropped off by train. I thought that was quite the way to start an adventure. We spent a lot of time up in the dome car that was available to anybody. And I remember that being a fun way to get a different perspective. We did not take a sleeper car. I don't think we even considered it for budget. And I don't remember that I went to look at what the sleeper cars were like. I think there were some, but I didn't really go investigate. Or if I did, I'm not remembering. I also don't remember much about the dining car. I think we brought most of our own food with us. there was plenty of seats so that when it was time that we tried to sleep, we could just, you know, have two apiece or, you know, have a whole row to ourselves and curl up as best we could. And it got long and tedious for a while, but it was mostly fun. When we got into Toronto, we were able to find a way to stash our stuff at the depot somehow at the train station and go walking around for a few hours before time for the train to Montreal. I don't remember a lot about Toronto. I remember trying to locate where there was some building that was especially tall, and we didn't try to go up or anything. We just kind of, it was something to look for as we were walking around. And so it was just fun to get out and stretch our legs. We did the same thing in Montreal. And there I remember that we found some kind of memorial garden that was really, really fun. And then the last train, I think, was overnight again. And sort of more like a commuter train that was going from Montreal to Quebec City. And I remember that one being really quiet, just everybody asleep. And so then Judy's sister and brother-in-law met us in Quebec City, and we got off and had another adventure there. And then, of course, after several days with them, we had to come back, reverse the whole process. When we went to get on the train, Jacques, Judy's brother-in-law, was helping hand up my luggage and actually got on the train to get my luggage up, or get my big suitcase up. And the conductor was kind of scolding him, you know, saying, "You have to get off." And he says, "Oh, tout sweet." So that was one of my little memories. Yeah, Jean and Jack were very, very hospitable and helped us have a really, really good adventure in Quebec. So that turned out to be quite the adventure. We got back to Armstrong, had to retrace the whole trip, got back to Armstrong, had to wait a while for our friend to come pick us up, and then, of course, drive home. So it was a multi-part trip. But it was a lot of fun to do that by train. A grand adventure.
Thank you, Becky and Judy, for inviting her along on that trip. It brings to mind a lot of things, that all of which we won't have time to talk about. But one thing I really enjoy about Amtrak travel is the employees are real people. And I haven't flown for over 10 years now, but it just seems like the whole airport scene and airport employees and the stewards and everything, it's all so plastic kind of somehow. If people are not behaving normally, it just seems like
robotic.
That's a good word for it. Yep. Mm-hmm. And there's a person assigned to each car of the train to take care of the cleanliness, and you don't usually need much attention there, but there is one person assigned to be sure that your car is taken care of. And my last trip out, I had an especially good guy. And if we have time at the end, I'll play the lecture that the employee gave to the dome car people that I had played back in our summer episode that I thought was so funny. But we'll forge ahead here. Now we're going to transition into commuter train stories and other means of commuting. So we have more than one story here from Leslie, who said, "Trains had been a huge part of my life at times." And so she just had to send more than one story. So we'll hear at least two of Leslie's commuting train stories coming up next year.
Hi, this is Leslie, and I have a story about trains. Toward the end of my freshman year in high school, I auditioned on flute for the Chicago Youth Orchestra of about 100 members. I was up against team musicians from a 50-mile radius around the city. I'd studied the instrument from fifth grade with private lessons and in-school concert band and orchestra, but I was amazed that I'd been accepted as the sixth chair flutist of six. I had to become pretty independent in order to fulfill the obligation. First off, I had to actually practice the challenging orchestral music by the greatest composers in the world, explain to our high school director, Doc Peterman, why I could not participate in marching band, and get myself to Saturday morning rehearsals. Dad drove me downtown, the 25 miles or so, for the first few rehearsals. Then I was on my own. The last stop for one of the elevated trains going to the northern suburbs was Wilmette, where I grew up. I'd wished for the Chicago and Northwestern commuter train, but I found that the CTA, Chicago Transit Authority, elevated system got me closer to Orchestra Hall, where the rehearsals were. Not the cleanest and safest mode of transportation, but I really had no choice. It was difficult on some commutes to keep from napping at 8 a.m. I was leery about closing my eyes and always made sure I held tight to my flute case and purse. It might have been a people watcher's paradise, but rocking back and forth, the numerous stops for folks getting on and off, occasional outbursts by folks with apparent mental illness challenges. It wasn't a pleasure, to say the least. The elevated train system had many routes going through numerous parts of the city, and it was just that. Tracks elevated above the city streets behind older apartment buildings. I read that the first leg was built in 1891. As I rode to my rehearsals of the most beautiful music in the world, it was such a contrast. The first-hand views of some of the city's most impoverished dwellings. This had been my Saturday morning routine for 3 high school years, and I grew a great deal. Emotionally, physically, not physically, musically, and socially, it might not have been possible without independent transportation to downtown on the L, the elevated system in Chicago. Hello, it's Leslie about trains. When I graduated from high school, I decided to go for a job in downtown Chicago. I was encouraged to go to banks as the pay was okay and the benefits were excellent. Hartford Plaza Bank at 100 South Wacker was where I landed a file clerk position, and it was an easy commute on the Chicago and Northwestern trains from home in Wilmette. After a few trips to work, I ended up sitting next to, of all people, the president of Hartford Plaza Bank, Larry Northrup. We'd meet every morning for several weeks and formed a real connection thanks to the commuter train. I loved our conversations, and Mr. Northrup proved to be a very caring man, welcoming me with a daily smile and cheerful greeting. Before too long, I chose to move to an apartment on Chicago's north side. I began traveling on the elevated train and a connecting bus. One payday on my way home, and at a usual stop by the Cabrini Green Housing Project, I had been dozing and woke up very startled. 3 young males with masks had boarded the bus, and the commotion woke me. They had guns, which turned out to be toy guns, in an article later in the newspaper. One demanded that all women put their purses in a large bag, while another held that gun to the driver's head, demanding he keep driving. A woman fainted in the aisle, but the rest of us complied, and the driver was ordered to drive again. The bus pulled over when ordered, and the boys fled. The Chicago Transit North Authority police soon arrived on the scene, taking names and statements about property loss. The incident and all account of losses made front page news in the Tribune and was the start of a few additional such robberies. Mr. Northrup proved to be an even more mensch when he insisted on reimbursing me for my purse and its extensive contents simply because I had been on my way home from work.
So, some of the perils of public transportation.
Yes.
Yeah. Taking certain things, certain risks, but hopefully the future of mass transit will
afford us more opportunities to use multi-person transit.
And improve. Yes, exactly. Well, thank you, Leslie. Yeah, we can see that various trains have played a role in your life. We're going to shift gears a little now. This is actually into a different means of transport mostly. Richmond talks a little bit about his lack of train experience and then merges into another subject that we'll tackle next.
I've never traveled by train, though there is a memory of getting onto a moving train, running, and reaching up to grab the ladder of a boxcar. That's all there is. Did it ever happen, or did I dream it? All aboard! I've walked lots of train tracks, though, balancing on the rails. When I was at Coon Rapids High School in the late 1960s, Coon Rapids was an outlying suburb with lots of unexplored nature, and walking the tracks would take me to friends' homes, down the tracks, over the creek, through the woods to the Chavis family, to see my friend Dave. We were 15 and we'd first met walking the rails by his home. The Chavises were a family of 13 living on 13 acres. Down the tracks, over the creek, through the woods, was a bridge made up of railroad ties, a bridge that we used to jump off of to get into the creek and play with the currents. Walking the tracks, it's against the law, trespassing, away from prying eyes. That's where folks go to be left alone. Down the tracks, into the woods, I'd a friend who used to go visit the tramp camps. His words, not mine. He'd always bring the folks some drink and some weed. In exchange, they would tell their stories. Dennis felt at home with the homeless. Afterwards, he'd go home and back to being a chiropractor. Hitchhiking is another form of travel that's a bit edgy. My friend Duane and I hitched up a ride to Pensacola, Florida, late summer 1971. No money. We had a book by Ewell Gibbons, Stalking the Wild Asparagus. We thought we were going to live off the land, on things we could forage. We had no experience in this, just the book. We went hungry. One night, we slept on a concrete slab, back of a backwater convenience store in somewhere nowhere Louisiana, where we were accosted, chased out before dawn by the person opening the store. He yelled and threatened to call the police. We were very afraid. We then walked down the road a bit further and slept in the dirt by a river, where I was terrified the alligators were going to come eat me. In and around Gainesville, Florida, we slept the night on the beach, the Gulf Coast, and the first time I'd seen the ocean. White sand beaches, warm waters, a blue that I'd never seen on the color wheels in art class. We swam and took to washing off the ocean salt in the outdoor showers. On the road again, a woman picked us up and gave us a ride in the back of her pickup truck. She also gave us an overlarge, ornately illustrated copy of the Bhagavad Gita, which, stuffed into my knapsack, came with me all the way back to Minneapolis. In Pensacola, Florida, we still had no money and no food, but there were coconut trees everywhere, coconut trees lining the boulevards, dropping their coconuts on the sidewalks. I'm not sure how Duane and I managed this. They are a tough nut to crack, but managed we did, and had our fill of sweet coconut meat and milk. Another first, never to be repeated. We finally met up with the gal from Pensacola, for which I should have mentioned she was why my friend and I hitched from Swan River, Minnesota to Florida, 1,443.3 miles, the girl he wanted to marry. Except when we got to her residence, she was living with her parents in a ritzy place by the canal just off the bay. Awkward. She didn't want us there, and the parents did not want us there. Two unwashed hippie boys washed up on their shore after 7 days on the road. After that, Duane hitchhiked back to Coon Rapids, and I on my way to California. But after getting picked up by a scary dude in a yellow Beetle Volkswagen, I opted out on California and went to see my half-sister Darlene in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where I stayed for a month. The visit was memorable, and I went to a movie theater, and I saw Getting Straight with Elliot Gould and Candace Bergen. It's also where I did my first ceiling plaster repair and paint job for a co-worker of my half-sister. Learning on the job, it turned out well, and I got paid well enough to buy a bus ticket back home. Homeward bound. Arriving in Minneapolis Bus Depot, which later became the legendary First Avenue nightclub, I called my mother in Coon Rapids and asked her to come pick me up. It was a late-night arrival for the bus, as I recall, and she did not like being woken up to come get me. Probably I should have let her know in advance. My final two Hitchin' a Ride stories are hitched with my best friend Dave from Coon Rapids to Hibbing, camped out in a farmer's field. We were just about asleep when the farmer showed up with a shotgun, thinking we were two escaped prisoners from Moose Lake Penitentiary. It took some time talking to convince him we weren't escaped prisoners. Later, he brought us peanut butter jelly sandwiches and milk. There were many rides up old Highway 65 from Minneapolis to our farm in Swan River, 152 miles. Sometimes I'd end up stranded at night on a lonely stretch of highway past Big Sandy Lake, where I'd have to call from a convenience store phone booth, spending my last dime and asking my father to drive 50-some miles to come get me. Do you see a pattern here? Late-night calls to parents to come get me. Stranded, somewhere, with no money. Hitching rides in the 60s and 70s felt pretty safe. I only remember a couple of scary moments. Times have changed, though, and now I have a car. A thumb goes up, a car goes by. It's nearly 1 a.m., and here am I. Hitchin' a ride.
Thank you, Richmond. So listening to that, I told him that actually we've thought about having a whole episode on hitchhiking.
I think we should.
Yeah, there are some good stories out there, and we'll certainly issue a disclaimer that this is not recommended behavior anymore.
No, but I think most stories are from the past.
Yes, I mean, well past.
And we survived.
Mm-hmm, yep. Yep. And he said he's got lots more, so we didn't have to save this one for that show. He's got more hitchhiking stories. So now, do you have something to add?
I was going to say that I think I'm going to write out a few of my train stories because these that have been shared with us have really jogged my memory.
Oh, interesting.
Some great train stories.
Uh-huh. Great. Yeah, and people are always invited to submit to previous episodes, and we don't always have such a full show as today, and we can always make room for belated submissions.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So one more. This is our last one, and this is a total shift of gears, and I'll just let it roll, and you can listen and enjoy.
When I was 27, living in Madrid, I had the opportunity to sail from Spain to Senegal on a Spanish container ship, as the only female and the only passenger. For 2 weeks, I lived on board the MV Marfil as we crossed the Mediterranean Sea and sailed through the Strait of Gibraltar, making calls in Casablanca, Morocco, and Spain's Canary Islands before arriving in Dakar. Hitching a ride on the MV Marfil. We had set sail a week ago from the port of Valencia, Spain. In another week, we'd reach Dakar, Senegal, my destination. Container ships in those days had nothing luxurious about them, at least not the ones belonging to the Mediterranean Africa Container Line. The first 2 days I had struggled to find somewhere to hang out where I wasn't in the way of the busy crew going about their daily chores and that didn't involve a hard, cold, inhospitable steel surface. Given the situation, flipping my days and nights made sense, and I had settled into a quiet routine, spending most nights up on the bridge with the officer who had been assigned to the 8-hour night shift while the captain slept down below in his quarters. Being up there all night allowed me to have one-on-one conversations, and I mostly listened. Stories of heartache, estrangement from loved ones, homesickness, difficulty adjusting to life on land after months and months at sea, petty work complaints, and big hopes and dreams. While I'll never know why the officers chose to confide so intimately in someone so foreign to them during those long nights on the bridge, I am sure the sound of the ship cutting through the waves, the interminable black expanse of the sea stretching forever in all directions, and the zillions of bright stars overhead had something to do with it. The crossing from Casablanca to Gran Canaria Island had thus far been uneventful, and another day on the MV Marfil stretched out in front of me. Blue sky met blue sea, the horizon thread-like and barely visible. Travel on such a large vessel feels like it's happening in slow motion. Unable to sleep in my tiny, stuffy quarters in the depths of the ship, I had ventured up on deck for some fresh air. I lay down on my back between two very high stacks of 40-foot containers and gazed upwards, the cold steel of the deck feeling oddly inviting and the steady humming from the engine room several stories below creating a dull vibration in my chest. I crossed my arms over my belly and drifted off, lulled by the gentle roll of the ship and the warm sun overhead. Suddenly, I felt it, a scarcely noticeable yet persistent tugging sensation on my wrist. I waited. Then, with my eyes half closed and with infinite care, I ever so slowly raised my head slightly off the deck and looked straight into the eyes of a small bird pecking industriously at the 10-foot loop of beaded bracelet made with bright red seeds from Bolivia that was wrapped at least half a dozen times around my wrist and up my forearm. I remained still. Unafraid, my small friend didn't waver, but stood its ground. Peck, 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 peck. As I watched the tiny creature attempting to eat bright beads from my arm in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, I felt relieved, knowing I wasn't the only one hitching a ride on the MV Marfil, and that soon we'd be reaching our next port, where my fellow traveler could enjoy a proper meal.
Beautiful story.
Yes.
Thank you, Jude. I think that's the first time we've had her on an episode, but we do have another submission to look forward to from her, and hopefully she'll continue.
Yes.
That's
great storyteller.
Indeed. Okay. Well, that pretty much brings this episode to a close. It's been really interesting, but it will be continued somehow.
Well, we had too much material in order to fit
yes.
in yours and my story as well.
First time that that's happened. So
and a great problem to have.
We're
thank
not
you.
Complaining, right. So we look forward to sharing stories, in my case, of various kinds of train travel in Korea, especially. And Frances?
My memory's been jogged, so I've got some Long Island Railroad, various Amtrak travel from Paris to the countryside, and my most favorite is the one in Japan.
I can't wait to hear. Okay, well, remind us the prompt for the next episode and when it is, and the deadline, Frances.
Spontaneous generosity. Have you experienced any random acts of kindness? Have you been on the receiving end, and did it make an impression upon you? Mm-hmm. You can send your responses to us via our email address, ktwhwriters@gmail.com. So if you give us your responses by Wednesday, we're going to be recording early.
Okay, we'll go out with a little bit from Arlo Guthrie, The City of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail. 15 cars and 15 restless riders, 3 conductors, 25 sacks of mail. All along the southbound Odyssey, the train pulls out at Kankakee and rolls along past houses, farms, and fields. Passing trains that have no name, and freight yards full of old black men, and the graveyards of the rusted automobiles. Good morning. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done. Dealing card games with the old man in the club car. Penny a point, ain't no one keeping score. Pass the paper bag that holds the bottle. And the sons of Pullman porters and the sons of engineers ride their father's magic carpets made of steel. And mothers with their babes asleep are rocking to the gentle beat, and the rhythm of the rails is all they feel. Good morning. City of New Orleans, I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done. Nighttime on the city of New Orleans, changing cars in Memphis, Tennessee. Halfway home, we'll be there by morning. Through the Mississippi darkness, rolling down to the sea.